Chapter 1. "Strongest grip in a girl I ever saw," Daddy said. "Not without some pride." I looked down at my palms, rubbed raw, where earlier I'd clung to the elm tree in our front yard with my no-good, stinking brother Bill pulling on my leg to get me down. He'd called me in for mealtime, and I didn't want to jump to obey his word, so there'd been a good 5 minutes of yanking and gripping before Daddy put a stop to it. I still wasn't feeling anything in 4 of my fingers, but his praise was a cool, clear salve to those burning digits. A salve, that is, until Mama chimed in with, "Just like the day she was born." Once she said that, no amount of moaning on my part could derail her from telling the legend of Baby Susie, and believe me, I tried. Changing the subject didn't amount to anything. Lying about our cow going into labor didn't do any good. Possibly because she wasn't pregnant at the time. Ignoring my petulance, Mama launched right in. "The day you were born, Lampite, you gave me more trouble than I'd ever had with your sister and brothers." This was no small thing. Mama had 3 kids before me, and according to her, each one had been a trial. "I thought I knew all the ins and outs of birthing, but you gave me a real ride. You just didn't want to leave. You were holding on for dear life to keep from meeting the world." Then she began to laugh. My mama cannot talk about the day I was born without bursting into giggles. Granny says it's unseemly. That means whenever she gets to the hilarious part, Granny will totter over and start poking her with her cane, which only sets my mama off further. "Get a hold of yourself, woman," Granny says. "Birthing babies is our war, and telling stories of it means telling about all the bloodshed and battles we overcome. Ain't no time for tittering like a schoolchild." Then she'll poke me once upside the head with a cane and say, "You don't see this one acting the fool when you get tell that tale." I don't think it's much fair to get rammed in the head when I'm doing something she likes, but that's the way with Granny. Doing something right gets you 1 poke. Doing something wrong gets you a lot worse. Anyway, the reason I wasn't guffawing along with the rest of the family is because I've never found the story all that funny, and that's on account of how Mama ends the story. Finally, we get you out, and there you are, smaller than a coop's egg. This tiny little baby all flailing limbs and wailing cry, looking half starved, which is not obey a baby should be. But quick as lightning, you latched on and started drinking on me from the get-go. That's when we knew we would do just fine. A pause. Except nothing, I interrupted, not eager to hear any more. And I ate everything you ever put in front of me and stayed small, and that's okay, the end. Except, she continued, like she hadn't heard me, when your granny came in to take you so I could rest, and truth be told, I was pretty tired as well, we tried to dislodge your tiny baby hands from my hair and clothes and discovered a grip we'd never encountered before. Strongest thing I've ever felt from something that small. Could be you didn't just try hard enough, Granny muttered to herself. Mama shrugged at that. I was plumb exhausted, I admit, she said, but the harder I tried, the harder you'd grip. Every single time without fail, she'd start to laugh again, laughing at the remembrance of laughing. There's Granny, looming over me, trying to take the baby Susie away, and I just couldn't get you loose. And then suddenly, she snorted, which isn't ladylike, but at this point she didn't care. I'm laughing too hard to dislodge you. And then Granny gives it a try, Daddy continued, because by this time Mama was having a high old giggle fest and wasn't fit to talk, and she can't get you to let go either. Well, I tried, Granny snapped, but as soon as you got one hand undone, the other one would just snake up and grab whatever was in reach. She glared long and hard at me, like she was doing it on purpose. Not having anything to say to that, I said nothing. Now Daddy was laughing too, along with my siblings, even Bill was laughing. But that's because he's a nasty toad of a brother, and that look on his face wasn't because he found the story funny, but because he found my finding the story not funny, funny. Make sense? And then I tried to pull, Daddy said, and you just gripped your mama harder. I thought we'd have to take scissors to the dress just to cut you off. And my hair, Mama cackled. Oh, they're a regular funny troop, my family. I stood to leave, but Mama's hand shot out and grabbed me, and if there's any question of who I get my grip from in this family, they just need to feel that vise. You go nowhere. The thing is, she said, calming down slowly and looking at me with real love, I knew then that you were going to be one of my best and biggest problems right from the start. Knew it like I knew your pretty face. Because my girl's the kind who never lets go of something when she wants it. Never. Any fool can grip, Granny spat. It's the smart ones that know when to let go. Well, there you have it. My name is Susie Bowles, and I've never known when to let go a day of my life.
You know, Betsy, reading about Susie Bowles in your new book, Long Road to the Circus, it brought me back to my own childhood.
Oh, did it?
Oh, it did. I loved Pippi Longstocking, and I know as a librarian, you know who Pippi is.
Oh, I know Pippi.
Yeah, Susie kind of reminded me of her.
Oh, that's great. I'm actually reading Pippi to my son right now.
Oh, there you go. I'm glad to hear that Pippi is still out there. Only the difference here is that Susie is based on a real story. So I'm wondering if you can tell us about the background of this story, Long Road to the Circus, because it's historical.
Well, it's kind of a funny story. So it kind of comes in two parts. First, my family always had this strange story going back that my grandmother's no good uncle would cut out on his farm chores on a regular basis to walk to an elderly ex-circus performer's house to help find out how to train the horses to do circus tricks. This is one of those family stories that you kind of hear over the years and you don't really quite acknowledge to be true. and yet the woman's name was apparently something like Madame Marantette. And this story had been sort of filtered through my family for years. And then years and years later, my mom's working in an independent bookstore in Kalamazoo, and she learns that David Small, the illustrator, he's won Caldecott's, he's won National Book Awards, that he lives in the Marantette house in Mendon, Michigan. And she starts putting the pieces together. She looks into it, and lo and behold, Madame Marantette was real. It is entirely possible that my grandmother's no-good uncle was cutting out on his form for chores to go over there. And the more we look into it, the more interesting she becomes. So it sort of occurred to me, I was like, well, I've got this crazy family story. I've got David Small living in her house. How cool would it be if I wrote a book and David Small did the art for it, since we have this bizarre connection to this woman from the past?
So I'm wondering about the research, because if you're going to base something on a real story, you have to start digging into it. And I wondered if any of that involved close encounters with ostriches.
That is a good question, because yes, Madame Marantette owned many, many, many ostriches, including one in particular by the name of Gaucho. He was her favorite. He was the naughtiest ostrich by far. Yes, I did have to do, well, at first I had to do research on the madam herself. And in that, I got very lucky. David took me to the Three Rivers Historical Society, and we met Holly Stevenson, a researcher there, who handed me a packet of all the information on Madame Marantette I could possibly ever want. If you want to know Madame Marantette's grandparents and where they came from, I have that information. Because it turned out, coincidentally, that 2 years before, Madame Marantette had actually, they'd had a big exhibit on her. And so she had all the information. She had already Xeroxed it for me. She just handed it to me gratis. So that was lucky. And then, of course, ostriches. Now, ostriches are few and far and hard to come by in this part of the country where I live, which is, around Chicago. But I did sort of find some fantastic books that helped me. There was one in particular that was very, very helpful. This is a series called The Superpower Field Guide, and there was one on ostriches by Rachel Poliquin, illustrated by Nicholas John Frith, and it had wonderful information on ostriches, just the best stuff I could possibly use. So I used that book heavily with this book.
This originally, the idea came to you as a picture book, but it developed into, and tell us of what age group you're aiming for with this.
Sure. So this is an older book. This is for 9 to 12-year-olds, I'd say. And yes, I did envision it as a picture book because I thought, well, David Small, he's done some historical picture books. There's a wonderful one called That Book Woman that I just absolutely loved. So I wrote it up as a picture book, and I presented it to him, and he looked at it, and he liked it. But when he met with me, he said, I don't see it as a picture book. I see it as a novel. Which was a bit of a surprise to me, since I've never published a novel. He'd never read much of what I'd written before. I was like, are you sure? And he was like, yep, nope, I see this as a novel. So by gum, I went off, and he claims I did this in a year. I do not think that I did, but I went off, and I rewrote it as a novel, and went back to him with it. He liked it, and he filled it with illustrations.
Did you feel the ghost of, well, her real name is Emma Peake, isn't it? Did you feel her in his house?
Well, as it turned out, and I thought this was going to be a deal breaker, he does live in a Marantat house, but he doesn't live in her Marantat house. When we visited with the historian, we found out it was another house my grandmother's uncle would have been visiting. You know, she married into the Marantat family, which was a pretty prominent family in the Mendon area. And even to this day, you can see Marantat things all around. But that was actually sort of the family home. And no, it turns out she would have probably visited there, but it looks like she didn't actually permanently live there at all.
And she was married twice, right? And he was her first husband. There's a bit of a love story in this book, kind of in the background, a subtle love story, because the ostriches, according to you, were a gift from him. And that's why she seems so very attached to them.
Yes, her second husband was actually her manager. He was the one who sort of arranged for which, you know, I haven't really gone into her full career, but you have to understand, this woman was a major deal. She traveled with Barnum and Bailey. When the circus needed her, they'd pick up the car with her inside and her horse and her ostrich, and they'd go off. She, to this day, has the high jump record, side saddle, and the record for pulling a surrey with a horse and an ostrich together. She's kind of amazing. And yes, she eventually married her manager. They had a very loving relationship. And he was the one who gave her something like 18 ostriches in the course of things, including Gaucho, the most famous one.
Do we know anything about what happened to Gaucho?
We don't. And the kids have been asking me that. You know, some of the kids just glom onto the ostriches like, you know, how long did he live? I'm like, I don't know. I'm pretty sure he... In the book, he outlives Madam. In real life, I'm not so sure. I know that her will stipulated that she'd be buried with her favorite horse and favorite dog, which, by the way, did not happen. But she did not mention her favorite ostrich, so I'm not sure how long he lived.
As a librarian, what have you observed? This is kind of a little bit of a tangent here, but I'm curious. How are kids doing with reading these days, with all that's available, with electronics, with technology? Are you seeing them read with the same kind of hunger I remember from my childhood?
Oh, sure. I mean, that's the thing. Like,
oh, good.
It's not like when we were, you know, when I was a kid, when you were a kid, like every single child was a reader. You know, some kids were into sports. Some kids, you know, were glommed onto the TV, you know. But then you always had those, like, you know, those readers who just like intensely would just like read everything. Those kids are alive and well. They may read, you know, they may have different fascinations. They may be like, I need every single one of this, you know, Babysitter's Club graphic novel series. I have to read them all. But they do. I mean, you've got the kids who, like, come up to your desk and they're like, I've just read Jane Eyre. Challenge me. You know, and the kid's like 10. You know, it's so you get, like, the major readers just as much now as you ever did. It's just that they have more ways to read. Now you've got the kids who are into the audiobooks. Who are, you know, using their downloads and listening to the audiobooks. That way you've got the kids who are reading the comics like crazy, but graphic novels, which are much better than the Archie comics I had when I was a kid. You've got the kids who are just reading, you know, series after series, you know, and then you've got the kids who love a good, thick book. That reading that we saw at the peak of Harry Potter, yeah, it abated in fantasy, but those kids are still around and they are still reading like mad.
Another question as a librarian, because I'm hearing it in the news again about banned books. What are your thoughts on that in your role?
Yeah, it's very interesting. We've always had challenges. And they peak and then they go down and then they come back and then they go down. It's almost, you can sort of see what the national conversation is about by what's getting banned the most. If you look at the top 10 challenges that the American Library Association puts out every year of, you know, here's the top 10 books that have been challenged. That, you know, it's always just a fascinating litmus test. You know, in the past, we were seeing, you know, Harry Potter got banned a lot because, you know, it had magic in it. And that was, you know, anti-Christian. And you saw And Tango Makes Three was a hot book to ban because, you know, it had gay penguins. Now it's books with transgender characters. It's a lot of books that talk about racial issues that kids have to deal with. It's really just sort of shows what the whole country is talking about. And then on the other side of things, you've got people who are coming to the library saying, hey, look, this book that I read when I was a kid, it's got some super offensive stuff in it. There's some actual racist stuff in here. Should we have this in the library? So libraries are really dealing with this from all sides and trying to figure out what the solutions are. We're actually playing with an idea at my library of maybe creating little QR codes, putting them in the fronts of the book saying, hey, there are conversations being had about this book. Follow this QR code and you can see what people are saying about it. Here's different conversations. It might be a way of getting people to talk about things and have, you know, discussions about the book.
I just heard a librarian on local news, I think it was, saying, let us professionals, we're trained to do this, choose what goes on the library shelves, because we realize in our communities, we have a lot of different backgrounds, a lot of types of people, diversity, and then let the parents come in and choose what they want for their children. That made a lot of sense to me.
Well, it's always the thing that I am fine for. Absolutely, we want parents to decide for their own kids. It's when parents try to decide for other people's kids.
There you go.
That's when it gets a little more tricky.
That's what she was saying. Yeah, and I thought that was a good way to put it. Do you have any events, you, David Small, coming up that you want to tell us about? I realize you were recently at BookBug.
Yes, we were recently at BookBug. That was actually we had a virtual appearance at Literati, which is the bookstore in Ann Arbor, and then we had a live appearance at BookBug in Kalamazoo. So if you want to find the book anywhere that we've both signed, that might be the one and only place to find it. But no, we don't have any other events immediately coming up, but yeah, that may change. You never know.
Thank you for spending a few minutes with us. And by the way, you should do an audiobook. You read it very well. Not all writers do.
I got to audition the 6 people who did do my audiobook, but I also told them, like, I'd love to do it myself, but that's okay. Maybe next time.
Well, you got my vote.
Oh, thank you so much. And thank you for talking with me.